From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. New technology, cutting edge, innovative. That's what you call something you want to praise or sell these days. Today, we'll hear stories of American innovation, from the second green revolution of genetically modified crops to Corning, New York, where a small glassworks went from Pyrex to fiber optics. Some of the best stories come from the world of entertainment. Computer graphics filled the screens of the neighborhood multiplex with eye-popping illusions. Stuart Little's fur, the monster waves in A Perfect Storm, everything in Final Fantasy. The special effects are so good now you might think human beings will soon be obsolete in the movie business. But you'd be wrong. Digital photography and home computers are opening up the industry to ordinary people.
One of the exciting things for me about this technology is that, you know, it's up to the filmmakers that are using it now to really set the standards of what is going to happen in the future. Like, no one's really made up the rules yet.
That's Bart Cheever, co-founder of DFilm, a touring digital film festival. Cheever says the primary benefit of this new technology is economic. It's so cheap to make a movie using digital photography that virtually anyone can produce a professional quality film. Even major players like George Lucas are going digital.
It definitely is revolutionizing filmmaking to an extent already. Like, the first time that a digital film was shown in a film festival and competition was in Cannes in 1998. There was a film by a guy named Lars von Trier called The Idiots, and it was shot with a little Sony PC-1 digital camcorder, which is a camcorder that sells for about $1,500. And here it was showing in the main theater next to, you know, films that were shot on 35mm, very high production value films. And because the digital cameras are pretty high quality, it was able to hold up. And now if you look at the Sundance Film Festival that happened last year, something like 43% of all the films that were submitted were shot with these mini DV camcorders. So you see, in a course of just 2 years, the technology really being rapidly adopted by filmmakers. And the reason why is because it's so much less expensive to shoot on digital video stock than it is to shoot on film stock.
How does the quality of the digital image compare to the quality of standard film stock?
The quality is not as good as film yet, but it's rapidly emerging. And I think we're going to see a case within 10 years where digital video is very close, if not indistinguishable, from regular film stock.
What's the difference?
The difference is cost primarily. Like, if you look at The Phantom Menace by George Lucas, they think they shot on 35mm stock, and it cost them something like $1.5 million just in the price of film stock. And they estimated that if they shot on digital video instead, the price would have been $15,000. So, you know, you see there's a tremendous saving to the filmmaker, and that's, you know, important for someone like George Lucas, but it's very important for someone that's, you know, just making films on an independent level.
One of the things I read about it is that it will be incredibly cheaper for the filmmaker, but not necessarily for those who are going to show the film. The investment in the equipment that will put this in front of the public is apparently fairly substantial.
The projectors are going to be expensive for the theater owners. For the actual studios, though, I mean, they spend several million dollars on prints, just getting, you know, thousands of prints across the country. So if they're able to just beam a film to a theater and have it exist on a hard drive somewhere in the projection booth, it's going to be a huge savings for the studios. And that's one of the things that's sort of holding up projectors being used on a widespread basis. But I think that'll be worked out eventually.
What about those small theaters that can't afford to put in digital technology? Are they going to be stuck in the past if the digital revolution takes over?
No, I don't think so, because the price is coming down on these projectors. And you see, even now, digital projectors that are being sold for people for business presentations and so on. So,
are there things that you'll be able to do with digital filmmaking that you can't do with standard filmmaking?
It's up to the filmmaker and how they actually use the technology. But I think the main difference is that films are going to be shot for much less money, and it's going to mean that a lot of new people will be able to make film that have always been shut out of the entire process. I spoke at the Norwegian Film Institute last year, and a lot of Norwegian filmmakers were really interested in this technology because there's only something like 3 million people in the entire country of Norway, I think. So it never made sense for them to spend $1 million on a film that, you know, could never really recoup. And as a result, all the films that were coming out of Norway were shot in English. They were about subject matters that would be important to people all over Europe. So now if you think a filmmaker can make a film for $50,000, $100,000, all of a sudden those filmmakers can make films about subjects that are important to Norwegian people in Norwegian. And there's a sense that, like, a very important part of the culture is not going to be lost.
So the storytelling is going to be one of the great beneficiaries of this change in technology.
I think so, and I think that's really what happens when this technology trickles down outside of the community of professional filmmakers in Hollywood and really starts to get into the hands of ordinary people. I mean, we've heard about this before with the Super 8 camera and the video portapack, but I mean, now computers are in half of all homes in America. And I think for the first time, these filmmaking tools are really going to be available to a large part of the general population.
Okay, but tell me again about the look then. You think that there will continue to be a difference between the look of digital filmmaking and filmmaking as we've known it up to this point?
Right.
Why? What kinds of things?
Well, video is much better at capturing vibrant colors. And film has a much more subdued, rich, deep sort of palette to it.
What we'd call warmth.
Warmth, exactly. It's a matter of what, you know, the filmmaker is looking for in the film, and it's also a matter of what the public is just accustomed to. Now, if I go to see a film in a multiplex with my girlfriend on the weekend, it's like, you know, I notice a lot of things like the way the film jumps around, the way the film stock is scratched up and things like that. And it's almost like, you know, you come to prefer the look of a digitally projected work as opposed to film.
I suppose this is like CDs and LPs, isn't it? You're gonna right. concentrate on not hearing the pops and scratches.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it.
Is the impact of this, do you think, going to be in the theaters, or is it going to be more in people's homes?
Yeah, I do think that the long-term impact is really going to be in the people's homes. I mean, there's been three waves of this revolution. The first one was big-budget Hollywood films like Jurassic Park and the first Star Wars movie, where people were, you know, using digital special effects to create really entirely new types of looks. And the second sort of wave is what we're seeing now, which is Sundance and the independent feature film market, where we have, you know, almost half of all the films being shot with digital cameras. I think the third wave is what's going to happen when really people in the mass market start to adopt this technology to make short, very special interest films about their lives, you know, things that are important to them but maybe wouldn't be important to a lot of other people.
You know, we're told that it's not just a matter of having money and a camera. You got to have something more than that, don't you?
In terms of actually learning the equipment, one of my partners in the film festival used to work at the Children's Museum setting up digital film showcases and workshops. And it's amazing. I mean, I visited him in one of the classes, and you'd see these 8 or 9 year old kids, and they'd pick up a digital camera, and then they'd sit down for about a half hour, and he'd show them how to use a software program like Final Cut Pro. And within an hour, you know, they were up and running, like, you know, don't bother us. We don't need any more help. You know, we already know how to do this. So, you know, it does take a little perseverance and persistence to learn the gear, but it's really not something that's outside of most people's grasps. Beyond that, it's up to the filmmaker themselves what they do with it.
So you're really saying that in terms of the technology involved, just about anybody can do this. Now, that, of course, means that you're going to have an awful lot of things that nobody really wants to see, aren't you?
I guess. I mean, we're used to seeing, you know, 50 films come out of Hollywood every year that appeal to like a lowest common denominator. And I think it's like the magazine industry. You know, there used to be one or two big magazines like Time or Look that were big national magazines. And now if you go to a newsstand, there's, you know, just an incredible range of magazines for every sort of niche interest. And I think that's really where we're going with filmmaking. I mean, maybe the films that we see might not appeal to you or me, but there might be a small audience out there that is interested in them.
What do you think this means for the Hollywood studio system?
The type of stuff that we show in D-Film is really outside of that whole phenomenon. People are still going to want to go and see big-budget entertainment with big stars, you know, created by professional storytellers. But I think what this is going to mean in the long term is that there'll be a lot of other people that can be included in the process. There'll be a whole nother wave of filmmaking that's completely outside of Hollywood.
If you'd like to check out some examples of digital filmmaking, point your web browser to dfilm.com. Bart Cheever is one of D-Film's founders.
Well, I hope you come to see me in the movies. Then I know that you will plainly see the biggest fool that's ever hit the big time. And all I gotta do is act naturally.
Journalist John Greenwald writes about new developments in movie making in his newspaper column, After the Show. He's keeping his eye on digital animation, and there's a lot to see.
Lately, I've seen underwater animation, dogs and cats animation, real people animation, well, almost real, and scary monster animation. I've seen the old-fashioned hand-drawn stuff and the latest computer stuff. I've got drawings and pixels coming out of my ears. What have I learned from all this? Forget technology and technique. If the script doesn't work, the film won't. If the talent isn't in the words and storyboards, artists and technicians can't save the film. All the computer animated hair follicles or hand-painted eye candy won't make me enjoy boring stories and characters. The animated film that's created the most interest is the amazing Final Fantasy. True, I'll remember it less as a good movie than as an important one. Its characters are all digital, with natural body movements and almost convincing faces. The filmmakers were incredibly brave with their tight close-ups of computerized skin, eyes, and hair. After a while, I suspended disbelief and identified with them, as painfully cliched as they were. Equally impressive is the film's rich, detailed, and dark visual imagery of a near-future Earth almost destroyed by semi-visible phantoms from outer space. The phantoms are just high-tech, bug-eyed monsters, but what awful and astonishing creatures they are. The filmmakers could have cut and pasted real actors onto their computerized sets and scenery, and for all but a few scenes, it might have worked. But their characters had to visually fit with the gray, dusty, old-tech world they created for Earth's remaining humans. Plus, they needed one person to glow a bit from time to time. Still, I'm not worried about digitactors taking business away from real ones. I doubt if computer animators who work in teams of a half dozen or more for a single character can create all the subtlety, expressiveness, and intensity that goes into, say, a short pen performance, though I can see computers easily generating a convincing Keanu Reeves. I do see computers augmenting performances the way stunt actors now do. Computers are a great advance in filmmaking, but I hope they're not a setback to animation's historic creativity. And computers can fix poor scripts. That requires humans.
John Greenwald writes After the Show, a weekly column for the Republican American in Waterbury, Connecticut. When John Greenwald cries out for screenwriters who make you care about their characters, it's people like Andrew Davis he has in mind. Davis created a sensation in Great Britain with his adaptation of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. He told Steve Paulson he's done another Jane Austen book, Emma, and taken on classics by George Eliot, Daniel Defoe, Elizabeth Gaskell, and William Makepeace Thackeray. Not that he has anything against contemporary literature.
I'd be very keen to find 20th century novels that would stand up to lengthy dramatization, but you don't really find them. The big books with lots of plot tend to be these doorstep novels that you pick up at airports in which you can't really believe in the characters very well and the plot dominates everything. Modern literary novels are often very much just about the style in which they're written, or they give a certain feel of a certain very personal world, but you kind of look in them saying, oh, well, yeah, but what happens, and then what happens, and so on, and there's not enough of it.
That's fascinating for you to say that really you're better off going back one or two centuries for a novel that works on the screen today.
I think that's right, yeah, because they give you a lot of plot and often a lot of subplot as well, with depth of character, too. So, you're getting an exciting story, but your intelligence isn't being insulted. So these things are still worth doing, I think, and can say more about today sometimes than today's novels can.
Give me an example of that.
Well, there's one that I've just been adapting, which is filming now. It's called The Way We Live Now, but it was written in the 1870s. And the story is about an elaborate city scam. A guy who reminds me tremendously of Robert Maxwell, the financier stroke crook, modern financier stroke crook. This man is called Melmotte, arrives in London from who knows quite where, perhaps Paris, perhaps Vienna, but he seems to have lived all over the place. And he is a financial genius. And he sets up a plan to build a Mexican railway. He doesn't intend to build a railway at all. I mean, the thing is to whip up the shares and so on. Lots and lots of characters, and it's a kind of satirical picture of a big city and the people who live in it. And it's all about human motives and what people will do for money and what they'll do for love. I mean, if there were a novel about the world today that had as much in it as that, it would be great.
Now, you have adapted at least two Jane Austen novels, right?
That's right. I've done Pride and Prejudice and Emma, yeah.
Uh-huh. Why do you think Jane Austen seems to work so well on screen?
Jane Austen writes really perfect plots, I think. The way they resolve themselves is complex, believable, and satisfying. And also she writes great heroines, really intriguing ones. I think Lizzie Bennet in Pride and Prejudice is probably the most attractive of all her heroines. Emma in Emma is intriguing because she's enormously attractive but very willful and in fact full of faults. But I think they're also very often based on really basic, powerful stories, like a kind of Cinderella story. Her heroines are very often kind of not highly regarded in society, although we feel that they're very worthy and we love them. And they surmount obstacles to get to a happy ending. Sorry.
And especially because of their intelligence. Take Lizzie Bennet in Pride and Prejudice. I mean, a very smart young woman and very strong-minded. And yeah, she turns those into virtues.
I think that's one of the reasons they appeal so strongly now. I mean, a character like Elizabeth Bennet will stand up to autocratic bullying figures who occupy a higher status in society than her because, I mean, she believes she's right and she can do no other. And you think, yeah, go for it. And it's enormously satisfying adapting these things.
Now, you've also adapted George Eliot's Middlemarch, right?
Yes.
Is there much difference between dealing with a Jane Austen novel and a George Eliot novel?
There is a difference, but George Eliot, too, wrote great characters and wrote great dialogue. I think, in a way, she took herself far more seriously than Jane Austen did. You don't quite get that sparkling wit. But what I found with George Eliot, I know George Eliot fans might be shocked and angry to hear me say it, is that I think George Eliot always wrote too much. He writes these brilliant scenes, and then you turn over the page and you get a three-page lecture on what really happened and what you ought to think about it. And when the books are stripped of her, you know, philosophical pontifications on this and that, they seem a lot lighter and airier, and you get a chance to let the characters live on their own. But I know a lot of people would think that's absolute sacrilege to say that.
There is such a resurgence in these novels now, particularly as they've been adapted to the screen. And I guess I'm wondering, why now?
I think a lot of these books have a heroine. You identify with the heroine rather than the hero. And a lot of the end of the 20th century and the beginning of this one has been about, you know, what do women want and how can they get it? I mean, one really good contemporary instance, of course, is Bridget Jones's Diary, which bases its story really on Pride and Prejudice. I mean, it's got two men, one charming, ruthless and unreliable, the other one apparently arrogant, standoffish, nose in the air, who turns out to be the goody in the end. And it's a very satisfying plot, and it just seems to fit absolute up-to-dateness just as well as it did Jane Austen. I was one of the writers on the film adaptation of Bridget Jones's Diary, and the reason that they hired me was to make it more like Pride and Prejudice, you know, to really go along that road.
What does that mean, to make it more like Pride and Prejudice?
Well, it already based itself a little bit on, and I mean, it had a leading character called Mark Darcy. I simply made it, I suppose, a little bit more serious than it was, you know, taking his point of view a bit more seriously. He's a character who takes himself seriously, and he has problems with Bridget's booziness and frivolousness and so on, and embarrassing mother and so on. And I thought, well, we shouldn't make him a figure of fun. He's got a point of view, and I sort of pull the structure of the script more in the direction of Pride and Prejudice, and because the script, when I first came across it, was very, very funny, but it didn't seem to have a sort of structural shape, and I thought it should be very definitely be a romantic comedy at heart and have that kind of strong emotional pull to it, as well as being very funny. So that's really... And I think you never go wrong if you take Jane Austen as a model. I'm a complete fan.
Now, you are a novelist in your own right as well. Have you ever had one of your own books adapted to the screen?
Yes. I've written two novels. I suppose it's a bit of a sideline for me. One called Getting Hurt, I adapted myself as a BBC television film. And there I was encouraged to, you know, go further, develop the plot, put more story into it. And I think it was right because there wasn't perhaps enough story in it. But I wasn't wholly satisfied with the results. The other one, it's called Bee Monkey, was done as a movie, but not very successfully.
And you were not the one who actually did the screenplay.
I wrote the first two drafts of the script and was then sacked.
On your own novel.
Off my own novel. It was terrible. But in a way, I just told myself, well, you know, you do things to other people's novels. You've got to expect it to come when they do it to you. But it wasn't very nice at the time. And the film is there. I mean, it's possible to pick it up in video stores, I think, but it never really got a proper release, either in the States or in England.
So is the lesson, at least for you, don't let someone else your novel?
Lesson, well, I hope it's a lesson for Miramax and all those people, you know. I mean, if it's an Andrew Davis novel, just do it the way it is in the book and it'll be much better.
Andrew Davis is a novelist and screenwriter. He's adapted two books by Jane Austen for the screen and worked on the scripts for Bridget Jones's Diary and The Tailor of Panama. He spoke with Steve Paulson. We're talking today about the conflicting demands of innovation and tradition. Coming up, new technology in the factory and on the farm. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Remember those white casserole dishes with the little blue flowers? How about the Pyrex pie plates your grandmother swore by? They were made by Corning Glass. And these days, Corning's gone way beyond cookware, into specialty materials from catalytic converter substrates to fiber optic cable. All this from a small glassworks that made industrial history when it found a way to mass-produce light bulbs. Meg Graham chronicles the company's remarkable 150-year history in her book Corning and the Craft of Innovation. She told Anne Strainchamps that Corning's quest for innovation has taken it in many directions.
Pyrex was a very important product to that company, and in fact, so important that they almost considered changing the name of the company to Pyrex. But much earlier than Pyrex, they did tubing for thermometers. They did glass for light bulbs. They were a major factor in glass for vacuum tubes, for radio, for CRTs, for cathode ray tubes, for television.
What does Corning make today?
It continues to be in a number of different industries. I mean, one of its major businesses, for instance, is in substrates for catalytic converters. It makes the ceramic substrates, which is a very demanding product. And another major area they have is in substrates for biological testing.
Corning's management decided early on to commit the company to something they have over the years called the uncluttered path. What does that mean?
Well, to them, I think it meant a course of action based on technology that was not inhabited by some other significant company that they could have to themselves. And if they could push that technology far enough, fast enough, deep enough, that they could reap the rewards for that without having to compete with other major companies that were far larger than they were. So that means that growth is a problem because, unlike so many other companies that just assume that growth is a good thing, a company that worries about control has to worry about losing control if they grow too fast or too much. For Corning, the uncluttered path was the path that would allow them to make the best use of their technologies, the most profitable use of their technologies, without having to compete head-on with much larger companies.
But that must mean that in practical terms, they've wound up trying to stake out areas that were highly experimental or that people hadn't even gone into. I mean, it must have meant taking risks all the time.
Always. This company is phenomenal for the risk they've managed to take. If you look at the fiber optics story, for instance, it blows me away.
Wait, explain the fiber optics story. Will you sort of set the stage and how Corning got involved in this?
Well, Corning became aware that there was going to be a need for a replacement for copper cable sometime down the road. And there was theory to suggest that glass fiber might be a suitable replacement with obvious, much, much greater capacity than copper had. So Corning went into that business thinking, well, we have more expertise than almost anybody, in fact, than anybody in this form of glass. And it's conceivable that we might be able to develop something here that's better than anyone else can do. So here's the uncluttered path as a potential. But they weren't just going out and risking a lot of money on a whim.
No, but still, I mean, this is a time when the rest of corporate America is streamlining and downsizing. And Corning decides to pour enormous amounts of company resources into a product that nobody even wants yet.
Well, I think that's substantially true. And not only that, it was a time when Corning was downsizing. But the family had always been determined that in order to innovate, in order to keep the company, in order to keep control of the company, in order to keep it moving forward, they had to have some new product. And they always liked to look for things that had potentially major impact. And this was one of them.
So how did it play out? What's the end of the story?
Well, first of all, it has to be said that it was somewhere around 16 to 17 years before Corning made any money on its investment. That's a length of time that very few companies would be willing to keep something alive. But what happened, and here I suppose you could say they were very lucky, but this is a case of chance favoring the prepared mind, they were ready with a second generation of fiber optics at a time when the American telephone industry was breaking up. And MCI and some of the Baby Bells saw the opportunity to use fiber for long-distance communications as a way of differentiating themselves and getting ahead. So Corning was at the right place at the right time with fiber. The distinction that's always important to make is the difference between invention, which often is an accident, and innovation, which involves the activities of many, many different kinds of people, has to.
But so, practically, what does that mean in how you run a company and how managers talk to employees and how employees are treated?
I think, for instance, that it means balancing off things that other companies may take for granted, like productivity, the drive for productivity, the drive for efficiency, the drive for quality. All of those things are extremely important disciplines, but they can't be driven so hard that they counteract some of the things that are important to innovation. For instance, innovation requires a certain amount of redundancy. You can't squeeze out every extra minute that people have to think, or you can't squeeze out every research project that may not be right on task at the moment. You have to allow a certain amount of freedom for people to exercise their own ingenuity.
Are you saying that as a company, they've been more tolerant than many other companies would have been of the eccentric individual?
Definitely. In fact, their stories, and you can always tell a company by its stories. One of my favorites is a man named Jim Giffen, who was a very talented machine designer and quite an irascible man, quite difficult to deal with. And each new CEO that came in was told, you've got to do whatever it is that's important right now, and you also have to take care of Jim Giffen, defend him. And this went to some extreme lengths. For instance, Jim Giffen decided at one point that he really preferred to live in Florida, and he wanted to go down there and hunt and fish, and he just was sick of working in upstate New York. And so they called him into the office and they said, Jim, why are you unhappy? And he said, oh, I really want to get down to Florida more often. And they said, how often do you want to go? And he said, oh, I'd sort of like to go at least 6 times a year. And they said, well, what'll that cost you and your wife to go? And they made it possible for him to go 6 times a year. But then they said, what'll happen if we really absolutely need you up here? What should we do? And they decided the thing they needed to do was to ship his whole crew down to Florida to be with him.
You're kidding.
And that's what they did.
Isn't Jim Giffen the guy, the machine inventor, who...
Yes. One of Jim Giffen's key characteristics was that he was very contemptuous of people with advanced degrees, and that included even people with undergraduate degrees, but he particularly disliked people with PhDs. And, of course, he was surrounded by them because he worked very closely in and around the R&D organization. But in one case, there was a man named Howard Lilly, who was a famous physicist who was particularly interested in flow mechanics. And Howard Lilly had demonstrated that the method that Jim Giffen had invented for producing cathode ray tube casings, spinning them, that that method could not be adapted when television tubes changed from circles to rectangles. So Jim Giffen looked at Howard Lilly's proof that this simply could not be done, that you could not cast CRT tubes in the old way, and went home and that night devised a way to do this so that you could, in fact, cast them in a rectangle, and came back. And I'm convinced that what motivated him to do that was to show up Howard Lilly. I mean, he did it within 24 hours.
Meg Graham teaches management at McGill University in Montreal and is one of the founders of the Winthrop Group, a management consulting firm. Her book is Corning and the Craft of Innovation. Anne Strainchamps talked with her at her summer home in Maine. Innovation applied to farming techniques created the first green revolution, when high-tech fertilizers and pesticides vastly increased crop yields. But that's not enough anymore. The world's population is growing faster than our ability to feed it, and the environmental impact of all this productivity has sometimes been devastating. So what to do? Richard Manning makes the case for a second green revolution in his book Food's Frontier. He thinks the answer lies in biotechnology and cites the work of plant pathologist Robert Goodman. Manning and Goodman talked with Steve Paulson about the prospects for feeding the world in the 21st century. Robert Goodman.
Today, in the developing countries of the world, more than 1 billion people live on less than $1 a day, and 2 billion, 2.5 billion, live on less than $2 a day. 800 million or more children are poorly nourished, malnourished. The projections are for the world population to increase to 8 to 9 billion conservatively over the coming generation, and no more land to turn to agriculture without very severe environmental destruction.
You're saying if the world's population is going to double, the food supply has to double, more or less.
Yes, and in parts of the world where already people are very hungry.
Now, Dick, the Green Revolution was supposed to solve this problem, wasn't it?
And it did, and created a bunch of new ones in the process. In my lifetime, or actually in the last 30 years, we doubled the human population. And back in the late 60s, people were predicting worldwide famine. The Green Revolution greatly increased production and staved off that famine and allowed that doubled population to be fed, where there are fewer, percentage-wise, hungry people today than there were 30 years ago. The problem is it did so in ways that are incredibly destructive environmentally, culturally. They wipe out rural communities with industrial agriculture, and the technologies have reached their limits.
Well, this is quite a challenge. I mean, you're saying that we need to double the world's food supply in the next 20 years or so because the population will increase. We more or less reached the limit of the old Green Revolution, but it had, in some ways, a rather negative legacy as well.
That's the message. And it's hard to believe for most of us in the developed world where industrial agriculture is seen to be a success and it's seen to be what sustains us and does sustain us.
So where do we go from here?
We can't go the route of industrialized agriculture where only 2% of the people grow the world's food in the rest of the world.
Well, let's talk about what's happening in the developing world. Ethiopia. Dick, I know you went there. What's being developed?
Ethiopia is kind of an interesting story in that it has its indigenous agriculture. And Ethiopians prefer a grain called teff, which only grows in Ethiopia, essentially. An Ethiopian doesn't believe that he's eaten it all until he's eaten his teff for the day.
What is teff?
It looks almost like a grass head. It's very fine grain. There are some real challenges to it. It lodges. When the grain head becomes heavy near harvest, it tips over. That's a simple explanation of it, and gets in the mud, and it spoils about half of their grain crop. And so what's happening there, some local plant breeders are trying to figure out ways to breed a new variety of teff, or engineer, even if they have to, a new variety of teff that'll stand upright. And a simple solution like that can probably increase their teff production about 40-50%.
Well, let's take this as an example. When you talk about modifying the plant, are you talking genetic engineering here?
In this case, no. This is traditional plant breeding, which we've been doing really for 10,000 years. That's what agriculture is based on. We've been doing it systematically and directly for the last 100 years. And it's also rearranging the genes, if you will, of that plant. It's just doing it in a more wholesale fashion, but that's what plant breeding is all about.
Explain that difference between traditional plant breeding and the cutting edge of genetic engineering.
Well, I'm not sure I can anymore because that line has become very blurred where breeding stops and genetic engineering begins.
Plant breeding is based on making sexual crosses between closely related plants in the same species generally. But it turns out it's possible, and it's long been known to be possible, to make what are called wide crosses. You can take distant relatives within the genus or even outside the genus. Wheat, for example, is amenable to crossing with some of its wild relatives. These methods of doing wide crosses require laboratory manipulations very often. The problem, for example, can be abortion at the point of the zygote or the very early embryo. But if you intervene with laboratory techniques, you can make a fertile plant from these wide crosses.
So once you do this laboratory work, is that what we call genetically modified food?
Well, that is clearly genetically modified food, but what I'm saying is that that is a common practice that goes back decades. We haven't focused on it publicly or in any sense. It hasn't been controversial, but it amounts to splicing very crudely genes from other plant species and other plant genera into cultivated crops.
So the question is, are these processes really different or do they amount to the same thing?
They can amount to the same thing. There are ways in which the process can be, however, very different. You can take genes from bacteria and put them in plants by DNA splicing. You could take genes from very distant organisms, fish, for example, or from trees and put them into herbaceous crops. And therein lies some of the controversy. But the point is that the manipulation of the genetic makeup of our crop plants is not unfamiliar, and our relative comfort with the products of plant breeding, even these more exotic techniques of plant breeding that we have been just talking about, comes from the familiarity and the comfort that people have because we haven't had problems with that technology.
Well, let me try to put this in perspective, because it sounds like you're saying that there's no big deal if we splice and dice the genes as finely as we want. It's just the end of a long slippery slope that's been happening for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Is that what you're saying, that there's really no danger here at a scientific level, or there are no ethical questions?
That's close. It's very close to what I'm saying. And I think about this always in terms of domestic animals instead of domestic plants, because we can trace that line. And every time I see this little beribboned yappy lap dog riding in the front seat of a Cadillac, I understand that that's a wolf. And that's a wolf with selection pressure, human selection pressure on it. So that is a very long, slippery slope. Now, there are some dangers inherent in this, and I go into one case in the book that it does have some inherent dangers when we start messing with wild populations and we can't control the results of this. But whenever I hear someone say genetic engineering could cause an environmental catastrophe, I have to remind them farming is an environmental catastrophe and has been for 10,000 years.
Bob, what about you? You're a scientist. You're working on the front lines here. Do you make any distinctions in terms of the level of intervention?
The way I would come at that question, Steve, is to think about what's actually controversial and why we have a controversy. At one level, at important levels, the devil is in the details. It's how the technology is used, not the technology itself. There are things that you could do with genetic engineering, with gene splicing, that could be very dangerous. I don't think any scientists in the public sector, for sure, and even in the private sector, are knowingly doing things that they could calculate would be dangerous. The unfamiliarity with the consequences or the results of the technology, to me, are not a reason for not proceeding, but they're a reason for, when we proceed, proceeding with caution.
So all the concern, all the public concern about genetically modified food, what in Europe is being called Frankenfood, you're saying that's just way overblown. This is public paranoia.
It's a political controversy, not scientific, and it gets back to the drawing of the line. What's the difference between breeding and genetically modified foods? And that's a very gray area. But I think also the problem with that is not so much that it's overblown, but it's missing some of the key points, especially the social points of this technology. Distribution of technology is a really important issue, especially in the developing world. And anytime you squeeze a balloon, it's going to pop up somewhere else. And that's true of this technology. If we are able to eliminate it in Europe or in the United States or eliminate it from the public sector in those areas, the corporations are still going to do it to some degree. China will certainly do it to some degree. There's no way you can regulate the Chinese not to do this, and they're very good at it. The Cubans are very good at it. A lot of people are going to do this. But if you don't give access to this technology to people in the developing world, it'll be very much like not giving them access to computers, because a generation ago, people feared computers as a control mechanism, and they won't have this technology as it develops into something very important.
So to return to our original question about how to feed the world in the next 20 years, how to feed all of this doubling of the population, you're suggesting we have to employ all of the new technologies that are available, which includes genetically modified food, but it goes way past that. Am I getting it right?
I think what we're going to have to do is build the kind of intellectual infrastructure in each of the developing countries and let them decide what technologies to employ and make sure the range is available to them and decide what's appropriate. And in many cases, it's going to take every trick we have. It takes all the running we can do to stay in the same place. That's been the story of the human condition now for 10,000 years, and it's not going to stop.
Richard Manning's the author of many books, including Food's Frontier, The Next Green Revolution. Robert Goodman is a plant pathologist at the University of Wisconsin. Steve Paulson talked with him. So maybe only innovation will lead us safely into the future. But you know, sometimes the old ways are best. Michael Ruhlman found that out when he visited a boatyard on Martha's Vineyard.
There were these wooden boats, these beautiful creations of wood that were as refined as a Stradivarius, but were powerful enough to withstand dangerous conditions at sea.
Building wooden boats, up next. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Michael Ruhlman loves boats, wooden boats.
Wooden boats are alive. Wooden boats have a soul.
And Wooden Boats is the title of Michael Ruhlman's book describing his time, as the book's subtitle puts it, in pursuit of the perfect craft at an American boatyard. This particular boatyard is in Vineyard Haven and belongs to Nat Benjamin and Ross Gannon. They recognized a kindred spirit in Michael Ruhlman. It's pretty clear why.
They are living things. They're made of natural material, organic material, trees put together. And anything that has been living, any craft that uses natural materials requires more care, requires us to pay more attention to it. And that was part of the beauty of a wooden boat, that it demands your attention.
Let's go back to the birth of Rebecca, if you will. I thought that was a very interesting story. Was it Nat Benjamin who had gone south to bring a wreck north to refurbish?
No, it was his partner, Ross. It was a Rhodes design called the Jane Doré, and he and his family and a couple of crew flew down to Fort Lauderdale, sailed this boat that was held together with Bondo and duct tape back up to Vineyard Haven, where the owner, who didn't know a lot about wooden boats, was told that it would need a good $250,000 rehab before it was worth sailing again. And this was quite a shock to the new owner, and he wasn't ready for this. And Nat said, well, we'll build you a new one for a little less than that, using all this hardware and all these parts and the lead ballast. And Nat said, then you'll have the boat you've always dreamed of. And the man said, well, that's not the boat I always dreamed of. And Nat said, well, what is? He said, a 65-foot schooner. And Nat Benjamin, designer and sailor, perked up at that, and soon plans were underway to design that boat.
Nat went home and drew that boat, and you quote him as saying that it was the easiest design he ever drew?
It was as though, I think, he had the boat already inside him from decades of deep water sailing many kinds of boats, loving the schooner rig, seeing what shapes of a hull worked, working in boatyards in Africa and Martinique, and working for 15 years at his own boatyard. He had it in his soul what this boat was going to be, and so the lines came very easily.
How big a project is something like this? To the novice, it sounds enormous to think about putting together all of the pieces of a 65-foot schooner. Is it as big as that?
It's a huge project. I mean, yes, he's got these drawings on a piece of paper, but these drawings then are transferred to a huge loft floor, a loft floor that's 70 feet long and 30 feet wide, and you transfer the lines directly onto this floor in life size. All these lines represent pieces and measurements, and they're big pieces of wood. They're thousands of pounds pieces of wood. The big keel pieces are huge, enormous tropical hardwoods that are harvested by hand by one of the boatwrights who travels to Suriname and works with lumber yards to hand-pick specific trees that will fit specific shapes, that have specific curves in them that will benefit the boat. And to bring all these back and to start sawing out these huge pieces, and then when you have enough pieces to start putting them together, it is a big thing. It cost about $1 million. That's about the fee that they eventually charged the new owners. That's what the new owners would pay for this boat, which is very reasonable in terms of a 60-foot yacht, pleasure yacht. Hinckley, a top-of-the-line builder, charges at least 50% more for its top-of-the-line, if not three or four times as much for their fiberglass yachts.
Maybe this would be a good point, actually, to talk about the companion boat that you write about in Wooden Boats, the Eliasa Lee, which was built for considerably less.
It's half the size, 32 feet, but costs less than a tenth to construct. As a boat grows in size, the growth is exponential. The amount of work, the amount of weight, the amount of money it costs, the amount of time it takes is an exponential growth. It doesn't just add on top of each other. So this was a much more manageable boat. I think it was a boat for $85,000 was the original price. You know, outrageously cheap, probably too cheap for the boat builders to do. A power boat, they hadn't done a power boat. And Nat got to design a boat that he cared about and loved, which was a boat based on the work boats of the 1930s. So that was a fun boat to build, a different kind of boat for them and a different shape. It didn't have the sort of whale-like shape of a sailboat, but a more lobster boat-like with a big flat bottom and a big beamy, big wide bow.
I have a clear picture in my mind of these two boats, and I guess I see the Rebecca as the aristocrat and the Eliasa Lee as the workboat.
Perfect.
With broader shoulders, I guess you'd say.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
When this boat goes to sea, is that wooden boat going to be more forgiving because it has this flexibility, I guess,
sure.
ingrained?
Yeah, all these pieces, because it's not a monocoque hull. The hull is composed of all these planks and all these pieces. It's got a lot more give to it. So in one sense, that is better. On the other hand, all these moving pieces and shifting pieces, places can open up if it's not properly built, if it's not properly maintained. These places where wood comes together can come apart.
There was another point in the book. You described a trip that a couple of fiberglass sailors took, pushing their fiberglass boat perhaps a little too hard.
And it's so true. And anybody who's been on any kind of fiberglass boat in a storm or in tough conditions can tell you the boat, the hull flexes. And in this case, the case that I mentioned, the hatches pop open. The whole shape changes so much that they couldn't open drawers below deck because the shape of the hull was changing. So it can be dangerous to have a sort of one solid, single-pieced hull in that kind of conditions. Nat Benjamin, who delivered many plastic boats, fiberglass boats, down to the West Indies, learned to dislike them because they were so cheaply built and they fell apart on you. And you can't have a boat falling apart on you at the very moment when you most need that boat to stay together, which is in rough conditions.
I suppose that must happen with a wooden boat as well, but you have the feeling that you can put it back together again?
You can fix a wooden boat a lot easier, even if something, if you spring a leak out at sea, as Nat did once on his first transatlantic sail on an old Block Island schooner. There was a leak in the hull, and they were able to just stanch the leak and work on the hull underwater and get a piece of goopy canvas over it and nail it into the hull, and it stayed for another 700 miles. So you tend to be able to fix wooden boats a lot easier.
Both of the boats that you write about, the Rebecca and the Eliza Lee, are, I think, aptly described as dream boats. Are all wooden boats dream boats?
They seem to have that component quite a bit. They're so beautiful. Something happens to people when they see a beautiful boat or think about a beautiful boat. They become boat-struck. Something hits them, and they become unreasonable often, unless your boat's smart. Wooden boats always have, and probably always will have, that romantic quality to them, that the capacity to dream about boats is particularly acute when you're talking about wooden boats. There's just something about all that wood shaped into these beautiful curves that you can sail away on.
Michael Ruhlman is the author of several books, including Wooden Boats. He lives in Cleveland and sails whenever he can. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy this program on cassette. Just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for Embracing Innovation. Program number 819A. To let us know what you thought of the show, write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706, or send us email through our website, www.wpr.org/book. We always like to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.